Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and for this special New Year episode, I'll be looking back at some of the top stories of 2018 with editor Simon Lambert and assistant editor Lee Boyce. And don't worry, this is a relatively Brexit-free zone. We did do a special podcast on that a few weeks back. Do go on iTunes or Audioboom or the This Is Money webpage to listen back to that one. But on the list, the NHS turned 70 last year. It got a big birthday boost from the Prime Minister, but not enough to secure its future for the next 70 years and beyond. So what is the solution? Would you be willing to pay more tax? The government also went green last year, from plastics to roads. But what would it take for you to ditch petrol and diesel and go electric? We look at whether the long-awaited interest rate rise was such a good move, how you can avoid inheritance tax turfing you out of your home, and last year This Is Money got tough on parking sharks. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, for a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
But first, in 2018, the National Health Service celebrated its 70th birthday. However, with an ageing population, the service is crying out for more money. In the summer, Theresa May promised the NHS in England an extra £20 billion a year by 2023 as a birthday present. Now, we're still awaiting more details on that, but it is clear that in the long term, it won't be enough. So where will the rest come from? Would you be willing to pay more tax? That was a question we asked back in June.
As a nation, it's widely considered that we would like to stick with the free at the point of use healthcare service that we have in terms of the NHS. Everybody is covered by healthcare. If you were going to design a healthcare system, the argument from a lot of people who work in healthcare, not just in the NHS, but the kind of people who look at all the different healthcare systems around the world, arguably the UK's is a pretty good one and you'd go for that kind of model. The difficulty is that whilst NHS funding has been protected in the years of austerity, as we tried to balance the books, having had to bail out our banks due to the fact that we borrowed stupendous amounts of money and allowed lots of reckless financial practices to go on throughout the 2000s, it has only been protected in the sense that it's not gone up. But actually, we need to be spending more money every year. So the widely considered figure that is needed is £20 billion. Now, Theresa May announced that we were going to get that.
Right?
A year,
right.
An extra £20 billion a year. Theresa May announced we were going to get that. She actually said £20.5 billion. That is by 2023. That's 5 years away. That only represents a 3.4% increase a year, whereas the health experts say that we need 4%. So it's still not quite enough, but it's a long way towards what the NHS probably needs.
While we don't normally like tax rises, and indeed I believe it was the Conservatives that said in their manifesto that they didn't want to raise taxes, this doesn't seem to be such an unpopular idea with the public, including this concept of a special sort of ring fence tax for the NHS.
Well, I think people, if you're going to bring in a tax increase, people like to know where that tax and where that extra money is going to be going to. Now, if there's one place that people don't mind the money going to, I would argue it probably is the NHS. A fantastic service, and I think a lot of us sometimes forget, you know, we may have had some bad experiences at hospitals and whatnot, but actually we are incredibly lucky to have that, you know, there. And yeah, we pay our taxes to use that. And if we are saying that more money needs to be pumped into the NHS, I think if people can actually see that, hey, like, you've got to pay an extra few quid a year and this is getting ring fenced and it's going to the NHS and this is where the money's going, what's going to be done with the money, I think people are probably more inclined to go, do you know what, okay, you know, we are getting older as a population, there does need to be more money put into the health service, and people are probably more happy to do that than other projects, I would argue. So sometimes it has to be done. But I was looking at some figures, and it's quite interesting because they're saying that the average annual rise since the foundation of the NHS 70 years ago is 3.7%. And then what happened, it kind of dipped under that a little bit under Thatcher and John Major, only a little bit. And then Tony Blair and the Gordon Brown era, it went up to 6%. was a big old jump in those new Labour years. And then the coalition came in 2010 and it went down to 1%. So it's really been skewed. Yeah. And I think actually that's put a lot of pressure now down the line onto the NHS. It's not just the population getting older. We're getting fatter. We're getting, you know, more unhealthy.
Also, I wonder, Lee, are other issues being brought into the NHS and where the funding needs to go than perhaps was originally planned for? I'm thinking things like mental health.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, again, these are all sorts of areas that need to be looked at. And I'd actually like to see a bit of a review of if there is some fat to be trimmed in the NHS and perhaps where some money could be moved over to other services that maybe need it more. But it's very difficult to balance it all. And there's a lot of different problems that people have across the country. And it's a very sort of difficult thing to get your head round. And it's such a mammoth organisation. I think the NHS, you know, it's one of the biggest employers in the world. I mean, it's a massive organisation. It's very difficult at a national level to look at everything. I like to think that things get a little bit more localised and seeing what needs to be done and where money needs to be moved. And you're right, there's things that have come out money-wise that I think that haven't been accounted for in the past. And again, it's making things, you know, way more expensive for the NHS.
Well, the Chancellor did say that we will have to pay more in taxes, but he would do it in a fair and balanced way. And he is also saying that the government will stick to its promise to reduce the nation's debt. How is this going to be possible?
Well, we've not got the exact details on that, and we're not going to get the exact details on that until the budget. Because what has been said is the NHS can have this money, but what they want the NHS to do between now and then is come up with a 10-year plan. And the NHS needs to work out how it's best going to spend this money, how it's going to trim out any unnecessary costs that it faces. It might even involve a wholesale reorganisation of the NHS, because there was these things called clinical commissioning groups that were started up. And the idea was that effectively, that's the stuff that isn't done by hospitals, but was previously done by GPs. They'd have to organise everything. But you put these groups in place that would be able to benefit from widespread negotiation, driving down the prices with suppliers, negotiating better deals, and just be better placed to do this kind of thing. Now, they haven't really been a resounding success, and there's now an argument that maybe they need to be taken out. The problem is every time you have a reorganisation, it's expensive. The figures that Lee mentioned there about the amount of money that went into the NHS are very interesting, but they don't tell the whole story. And through the 2000s, we put a lot of money into the NHS, and that was really good. However, not all of that money, but a lot of that money went into very, very high salaries for lots more bosses. So this was the problem, is a load of money was thrown at the NHS, but there was very little control about how it went in. Now, the classic example of that, not to go all Richard Littlejohn column on us, but was the Guardian jobs section, if you remember that, in its heyday of the sort of early to mid 2000s, which was a job section that came with the Guardian on a Saturday, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And you had these jobs, 5-a-day coordinators. I mean, who knew we needed a 5-a-day coordinator and things like that? But it wasn't even the 5-a-day coordinators that were the real problem. It was the people at the top, this level of middle and upper management, earning 80, 90, 100,000 pounds a year, and lots and lots and lots of them. And the problem is, when you've got an organisation as big as the NHS, and we've seen this with companies like Tesco, for example, gigantic. When you start to then try and trim costs, you suddenly discover that it's almost impossible, because everything you look at and go, well, should we be doing this, and should we be paying that person? That person goes, well, hang on a minute, I'm busy all the time. And you look at all these things, you go, yeah, well, they're absolutely necessary. So it becomes very difficult. Now, apparently 50% of this money is going to come from tax, and 50% of this money is going to come from extra borrowing a little bit more money. The idea behind the tax thing, and whether we have a hypothecated tax, is very interesting. A hypothecated tax is a fancy word for ring fencing the money. Now, there's good points to that and there's bad points.
Right, exactly. So tell us what's, obviously the good point is you know where it's going, but the bad points and stuff is, what happens if you over exceed that target? What happens if you under? Are you going to take money from somewhere else?
So you hit the nail on the head there. The good points are that people know where the money is going and people are happier to pay the extra tax. So if you said to people, tax is going to go up by 2p in the pound, everybody, well, why? Things aren't getting any better. Look at all the holes in the road. You're just going to waste it. If you say your tax is going to go up by 2p in a pound, because it's going to help the NHS and protect the NHS, then you think, okay, well, that's all right. Mm. And you have to bear in mind as well, these tax rises will fall upon two sections of people. One, the younger working population, who are effectively being asked to pay more tax in order to pay for the health service that is becoming more expensive due to the older population, who, not to get into intergenerational issues and things like mm-hmm. that, but they are the people who benefited from the house price rises, the final salary pensions, all those other things. And they're now supporting that younger generation, but that younger generation is being asked to pay for them. And I think there needs to be a recognition of that. But also it's going to fall on higher earners. Now, the difficulty with higher earners is that it's all very well saying, well, they need to pay their way, as Jeremy Corbyn did during the last election. But actually, if you look at the figures, they do actually pay their way. They more than pay their way. Yeah. In fact, they pay an awful lot of money. And people who are lucky enough to earn lots of money, i.e. someone who's lucky enough to earn £100,000. Now, that's a huge sum of money. That person is very lucky, and many of those people would consider themselves to be very lucky. But there's also lots of people who earn quite a lot more than them. They will be aware of that. But they do pay a lot of money in tax. They probably pay about £35,000 in tax all in. And now that's, you know, that's considerably above the average wage. So those people are already paying lots of money. And if you want to convince those people to pay more money, those are the people you've really got to convince that this money is going to go towards something good. And that's the people for whom a hypothecated tax is probably the most important, because they will say, all right, I will pay more money if you promise to use it to sort this problem. The bad things with a hypothecated tax, well, the economy moves up and down and the tax take moves up and down. So what happens when there's a recession and all of a sudden the tax take drops massively and you've got a deficit? You've got to find money from somewhere else to put into it. What if you end up with too much money? What if the economy does really well? Do you spend more money on the NHS or do you move it elsewhere? It'll be really interesting to see how this plays out, because there's been a big groundswell of opinion going hypothecated tax for the NHS. That's the one place where it would be good. But then you've got a lot of people on the other side saying, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this.
The government going green was also one of the big themes of 2018. Plastic waste very much in the news, but also up there was our motors. The government laid out its Road to Zero plan in July, adding some detail to its previous announcement on how they hope to get 45 million motorists in low emissions vehicles over the next 3 decades. We were already pretty familiar with the 2040 proposed ban on new diesel and petrol cars, but what else was in there and would it work? What would it take for us to go electric?
Basically, petrol and diesel cars are bad for the environment and bad for people. They create CO2 and they create gases that are harmful to people in terms of their breathing and things like that, such as nitrogen oxide. And we need to try and stop polluting as much. And so the decision has been made that we should push towards electric cars. However, there's not been a lot of meat on the bones of the plan as to exactly how we are going to achieve this. It seems as if this is one of those scenarios where the government has laid out what it wants to happen and is then leaving quite a lot of it up to private enterprise and people. It has said that it wants individual cities and towns to bring in their own methods for discouraging the use of the most polluting cars, which are decided to be diesels made before 2015 at the moment, and petrols made before 2006. That obviously could change, and that's the risk for anybody buying a car that comes after that is, well, what happens when they crack down further? Are they going to keep shifting this up? There's questions surrounding older cars, classic cars, things like that. But anyway, the plan is that we're going to shift towards electric, and so the government decided to explain a little bit more about how this is going to happen. But to be honest, it still looks a little bit hit and hope in terms of exactly how the infrastructure, which is probably the most important thing for getting people into electric cars, is going to happen. And also, at the moment, you get a subsidy to help you buy an electric car, and that is only lasts until 2020. And this report said that whilst there should still be some form of incentive, it doesn't necessarily see that subsidy continuing as it is at the moment. So it's difficult to see how we're going to encourage more people into electric cars, because at the moment, whilst take-up has been good and much better, they still only make up a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the number of cars that are on the road.
Lee, are you in agreement with the fact that this is the right thing to do? Because we hear a lot of criticism about the policies, perhaps they won't work so well. But in terms of the theory, the idea behind going electric is a good one. It's just some of the policy details that we're getting aren't quite perhaps thought out, as Simon says.
Yeah, what a shock. They've come up with a date, which is quite far away in the future, far away enough in the future to be, well, we can kind of, you know, develop a plan over the years and make this happen. But you kind of feel like the plan just sort of came out of nowhere. I feel like it just sort of, you know, was almost just said, right, 2040, diesel, petrol cars, boom.
But we've got quite a few, we've got a couple of decades to work this out.
Yeah.
What was actually in this road to zero? Lots of the headlines were talking about, am I right in thinking new homes would be built with charging for electric cars? What else?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a great sight, isn't it? For every single new build office and home is going to have a charging point.
But that was one of the problems, wasn't it? That there just isn't enough.
One of the biggest problems at the moment, there's a number of issues around electric vehicles at the moment. One of the problems is the charging points and having enough rapid charging points. So this sort of technology improves and evolves all of the time. And that's going to be one of the biggest factors between now and 2014, especially now car manufacturers are starting to take this electric car revolution a little bit more seriously, because they're, you know, being given, it's not just Britain, there's places around the world that are having similar bans on petrol, diesel. We're seeing it in our city centres now, you know, people being slapped with charges for having certain cars. And again, that's a kind of Europe-wide thing. It's happening across the continent. You've got that issue. Then you've got drivers that are not too convinced about electric cars at the moment. Well, the biggest one is range. People feel like they can't get a car for a good enough price that's going to give them enough range purely on electric.
What's range? How far you can go.
Right. So having your car fully charged and how you can get from A to B. And if you're doing it, not many people will do a daily long journey, but it's that fear factor of ever breaking down, or, you know, that running out of charge or something going wrong. I have a few other concerns as well. I mean, it's all well and good saying, you know, petrol and diesel cars are polluting, and we know that. But charging an electric car has to have a footprint somewhere, and that footprint's going to come via, you know, the national grid, and that surely is going to have an impact on our power stations. There's already, you know, lots of strain on our power network. What's going to happen if we're all plugging in our cars at the same time that people are still using their electricity in their homes and offices? That feels like it's quite a big one to be tackling.
Law of unintended consequences, I always think. A bit like the plastics ban.
Quite possibly. And the other one is the batteries on these. I mean, how are they being manufactured and then being disposed of and recycled? And I feel like some of these answers, you try and get the answers to these questions, and it's not always easy to get. I totally understand, though, you know, our city centres are polluted. You know, London streets, there's always those stories about, especially in central London, you know, going over the emissions very, very quickly. And, you know, we don't want people to be dying prematurely because of fumes that are coming from cars. But it's just smacks of yet another government policy of going, well, do you know what's a little bit in vogue at the moment? People are caring about the environment and they're caring about pollution. So, you know, let's go on this massive drive about plastics, and which is great, and a massive drive on electric cars. But it never, ever feels like it's been thought out. It's never felt like it's been thought out and then gone, right, this is the plan. It's more like this is just a really general, right, that's bad. Diesel, petrol cars, they're bad, they're polluting. But I don't feel like there's a massive plan in place to sort of get people to phase into electric cars. This report also said about not allowing hybrid cars under a certain range. So it have to be 50 miles or more pure electric for people to be able to get them. So they're talking about that happening from 2050. Again, it feels like a long, long time away. But people who are getting into the electric car revolution are tending to go for hybrid cars. They tend to be the best seller. So you could switch between electric and, you know, standard vehicles. So I don't know, Georgie, there's a lot of questions. This report answered a few of them, but I still think there's a way to go before we fully know the overall plan.
So, Simon, in the 6 months since that story, are there any indications that we are going green, that we're ready to ditch petrol and diesel?
Yes, there have been a few, in that we've seen the push to get electric car charging points up and running for more people to be able to use them. Supermarkets are going to get involved. We've seen more charging points go into our roads, and we're definitely seeing more of a concerted effort from the authorities and private enterprise to do that. But I still think that way too much of it is being left up to businesses to sort out. And the government, if it really, really, really wants to really push the electric car revolution, needs to pull its finger out. The one thing I would say, though, and this is a rare moment, hold on to your seats. Well done, Islington Council.
Oh, my word.
I know, amazing, hey? Islington Council, a much maligned organisation, and with very good reason on this podcast, they are my council. They have put in a load of electric car charging points. So having had many years where the nearest one to my house was a bus ride away, despite Islington maintaining that it was a green council, charging people extra money for driving diesel cars, etc., listen to podcasts past, there are now two on my road, two on another road round the corner, and two on another road round the corner. So there's six within walking distance of my house. And if you go round Islington, that they're popping up all over the place. So I still think that if there was lots of people who suddenly decided to go electric, they'd struggle to charge their cars. But you've got to say well done where it's due.
Simon, I did promise at the start that we wouldn't really go into Brexit territory, and we won't too much. But we did hear about the NHS turning 70, and we're talking about government proposals to make us go electric. Lots of policies have slightly gone off the boil a little bit, or had gone off the boil last year. Are we expecting them to come back on the boil this year?
Well, I mean, it depends on what happens on March the 30th, doesn't it? I mean, it depends how chaotic things are. I think unpicking the chaos may take some time if we do end up with the chaotic no-deal Brexit that people are increasingly worried about. But I think that there were things that have been delayed because of the Brexit scenario, one of which I would point to any form of tax rise to pay for more money for the NHS. There was talk that we might get national insurance tickled up a bit. There might even be a special ring fence tax or something like that. Obviously, the Chancellor decided not to launch that in the budget in November time, because what Chancellor would be crazy enough to do that in the position where nobody knew what was going to happen with Brexit? And since then, things have definitely got worse on the Brexit front. So I wouldn't expect it in March time either. But, you know, maybe next autumn we might get it.
All right, then, we'll put that to one side now. And in August, interest rates finally rose above 0.5% for the first time in almost a decade. The Bank of England decided that the UK's economy was healthy enough for rates to finally get above the financial crisis emergency level. But was the hike a wise move or a mistake? The Bank of England increased the rate from 0.5% to 0.75%, immediately hitting the 3.5 million people with variable or tracker mortgages who'll have to fork out a little more each month. Now, in theory, the decision should be welcomed by savers, but don't get your hopes up. Despite the vote being unanimous, though, business groups and debt charities have all questioned the move after some weak economic data and fears over Brexit, indeed a no Brexit deal. So was it the right decision? Why was it taken? And what lies ahead of us? So, not a surprise, Simon, but for you, now you've been calling for this, haven't you, on this podcast, for a rate rise. You think that we were ready for it? I assume you haven't changed your opinion.
The Bank of England base rate influences the rates at which banks and building societies lend to their customers. And it does this by influencing the cost of money on the money markets. Banks and building societies, when they make a loan to a customer, a mortgage in particular, the bank presses a key on the computer. The money is magically created. The work of the magic money tree. That £200,000 is transferred into your account, except it's not. It's transferred to your solicitor, who gives it to someone else to pay for the money. But essentially, it creates more money in the economy. Now, if you tinker around with the cost of those loans, then effectively what that is that's the price of money to you or me. The price of money is the cost of a mortgage, the cost of a loan. To a business person, it's the cost of borrowing some more money to expand their business, to invest some more, to buy some new machinery, and so on. If you raise the price of it, it lowers the demand for it. And if the demand for it is lowered, then there's less opportunity for banks to create money and put more money into the economy. If you lower the price of the money, then in theory, there is more demand to borrow that money, and it pushes more money into the economy. So what happened through the 2000s was we had a stupendous credit boom where people's house prices were going up and people were then borrowing more money against their houses, and they were then spending the money, and they were believing that because house prices were going to go up, they should buy more expensive houses, which chases house prices up, and then eventually the whole thing went kaput. So when that happened, it suddenly turned out that all of this money that had been lent to people, and then the bets that had been taken on the loans to people and everyone, was a colossal disaster. And the banks suddenly went, whoa, we don't know who owes who, we don't know who we owe, and we don't know who owes us, so we're not going to lend any more money to people. And what you saw is that independently of interest rates moving, all of a sudden the cost of borrowing money shot up, and so the demand for borrowing money sunk, and so you had a problem. So the Bank of England decided to step in this country. In the US, the Fed had already rapidly cut interest rates. The Bank of England went hacking away through the jungle of interest rates, and it took rates down from around about 5% to 0.5% in March 2009. And then they stuck there because the emergency measure was decided to be needed all the way through to just after the Brexit vote, when rates were cut again without ever having risen. But this week...
So why have they?
Well, this week the Bank of England has decided that finally the economy is in rude enough health that we can stomach interest rates of a princely 0.75%. The financial crisis is over, people. It's party on time.
And yet, if you listen to a lot of people, you'd think they'd raised it 75%. It was a Danny Blanchflower earlier saying he thinks this might prove to be the biggest mistake made by the Bank of England since missing the 2008 crisis altogether.
Well, it might be, but he's very, very vehemently opposed to a rate rise. The argument against this is that the economy isn't doing all that well. Consumers in particular are suffering. We do have a lot of debt.
Hang on, so companies, is the economy doing well or is it not, right?
Well, because you have some people who it's are doing saying, okay. It's doing okay under the circumstances of this no-deal Brexit that's hanging over us, but that there are already signs of stress emerging, and that to raise interest rates at a time of stress emerging, the catastrophe on the high street, consumers struggling, pay rises not really being that great, they're going up by a tiny little bit more than inflation. Inflation is coming down towards 2% anyway. We've got this prospect of Brexit hanging over us, which is going to act like a big break on the economy. So the argument against this is that why do this now when it's such a risk?
But also, why unanimously? Wasn't it 6-3 against last time?
Yeah.
And now it's 9-0 in favour.
Almost makes you think, like, when they voted 6-3 last time, they'd already decided that they were going to vote 9-0 next time, doesn't it? I mean, so they meet, they see all the evidence from the Bank of England's economists and the people who work there, they put it before the Monetary Policy Committee, and then they make a decision. I mean, I like to think that it's like 12 angry men. I'd love to see, you know, Mark Carney marching passionately around the room, convincing people to go for his side. Or maybe someone has managed to convince Mark Carney to go for their side. But what this indicates, and there's a couple of things in there that indicate this, is that they think the economy is in rude enough health to do this now. But there's a couple of caveats. One, I think they did this because they felt they had to.
Why? Because they'd made enough noises about it?
There was talk of them raising in May. Everybody thought they were going to raise in May. And then all of a sudden, a couple of weeks beforehand, Mark Carney said, well, you know, May looks all right, but there might be other times that look good too. And the rate rise just dissipated immediately. This time round, that didn't happen. So if they hadn't raised yesterday, there would have been even more accusations of the whole unreliable boyfriend and everything like that. I think Mark Carney's a strong enough character to basically bat that one off. But I think that's in their mind. I think the other thing is they know that they need to try and get rates up before a recession hits so that they can then cut them if they need to.
Yes.
They have a lot more leeway than they did last week when rates were at 0.5%. And also what's interesting in the report yesterday was that whilst rates have gone up now, which is possibly a little bit earlier than people expected, they're forecast to go up more slowly after that. So actually the shift in interest rates for us, for the US and for the Eurozone has moved backwards since May. So they're expected to go up more slowly now. And this is to do with all kinds of things, you know, like Donald Trump's trade war with China and stuff like that.
Do you think this could be a one-hit wonder, though? I mean, could we be talking about this in, you know, 10 years' time and say, oh, we've got the third one?
Well, it might be. I mean, I think that rates will get back to 0.5% before they get to 1%. Okay. But, you know, you never know. But the forecast that they had yesterday didn't show a move to 1% until the middle of next year. And then in 2020, we were going to get to the heady heights of 1.1%. So to get to the next rise, because they do it, they tend to do it in quarter points, to get to 1.25%, we could be waiting, you know, to the end of 2021. That's a long time.
It is a long time.
And we'll probably have a recession before
that. A lot to come before that stage as well. Lee, be that as it may, the arguments for or against, was this the right time? We are where we are at the moment, and that is with a little rate rise. And that little rate rise will be felt the most by those who have the least.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to hit people that have mortgages that are on a variable or tracker rate, for example, and they might be people that, for whatever reason, haven't switched to a fixed rate or can't switch to a fixed rate, and that's going to put more pressure on their monthly outgoings. There's been lots of talk about, well, it's going to be good news for savers. The rate's going to be passed on in the form of savings rates.
What did we see in November, Lee, when it rose last time?
We really haven't. But the thing is that the link between base rate and savings rates, you know, is completely out of sync compared to how it was in previous times. So the main battle with savings, as we've said in the past and have been saying for the last couple of years, comes in the form of fixed rate savings. It's very unlikely that a base rate rise is what stimulates the competition in that sphere. And actually, Mark Carney said savers need three elements for savings rates to go up. Number one was healthy banks. Well, I feel like we're in a stage now where healthy banks, that's a tick. I mean, we've seen results today from RBS, you know, looking like there's some green shoots of recovery and everything there. Banks are looking healthier than they did, certainly look healthier than they did 10 years ago. More competition from new entrants. Well, we've had a glut of new entrants come into the savings market in the last couple of years, so I don't know how many more new entrants are needed to push up rates to an actual above inflation level for people to get a proper return. And then he said new products and services from fintech. Well, I feel like that's already being ticked as well. We've got things like peer-to-peer. It's not really doing enough to get savings rates heading higher than what's needed. And people like having financial services compensation scheme protection, so they want to like invest their money, put their money into a safe place like that to get a return. And it's not happening. And Mark Carney's saying that this morning. It's almost saying, well, this base rate rise is not going to do much for savings rates. And actually, very few providers have put up rates today. And very few rates are linked to base rates. So, for example, some big banks say, well, we're going to pass on this to savers, but in the form of variable rate savings. It's a very small part of the market. It's nothing. But there's always going to be winners and losers in this sort of thing. There's probably going to be more losers, I'd imagine, than winners. And actually, there was also, outside of savings and mortgages, there were some stats out about credit card holders. You know, credit card holders are going to probably find it, they're going to be stung for more money. So Andrew Hagger, Moneycoms, said, if you're with, if you've got a credit card with Barclaycard or Halifax, your interest rate is linked to base rate. So higher rates will kick in straight away, right? So, I mean, that's not good news for people that are perhaps living on credit and struggling. He estimates that if all car providers were to raise rates by 0.25%, it would cost UK borrowers a combined £92.25 million in extra interest charges per year. Doesn't sound like a huge amount, but it is. People, and people are struggling. So,
and this is what the debt charities are arguing at the moment. People are going to struggle with this. While a lot of the rises will be, you know, 20 quid extra a month, say, on a standard mortgage over 25 years, you know, this all adds up and it could push a lot of people over the edge. But where is the balance to be had? Because we got figures out this week, didn't we, Lee, about how much we are going out and spending on our credit cards and loans and all this. And with that in mind, Mark Carney and the Bank of England have been worried about this for a long time and trying to do something about it. And obviously, they're not politicians, and I want to point that out. They're not. But what can we do? Because this economy is so linked to us going out and spending.
That's it. And it's a good question, Georgie. And it's, you know, like the circle of economic life, isn't it? I mean, it's quite hard to, you know, put all of those things together and to get the balance right for absolutely everyone in this country. It's a near impossible job. But the one thing I will say in terms of, you know, interest rates, if they do go up in the next 3 years, as forecast in that report, it's going to be very slow and gradual. And if you are finding it difficult with a 0.25% rise, especially something like your mortgage, then, you know, alarm bells should be ringing. You should be able to you know, you've taken a mortgage out, and let's say you are on a tracker or an SVR, you've got to think about the fact that mortgage rates have been so incredibly low. You don't have to go that far that back in time. Let's say someone had bought a house in the last 5 years, would look at some mortgage rates from, you know, the past and go,
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely... And we have got the new review, didn't we, that came, well, new now, it's 2014, that should be a bit stricter. So we shouldn't have so many people...
Exactly. So they stress test all of this sort of stuff now. So, you know, looking at your earnings and looking a little bit ahead. And they do stress test way higher than, you know, a 0.25% base rate rise. So, you know, it's very easy to say. But, you know, some people, especially if you've got a big mortgage, this could be a relatively sizable whack.
Now, Lee, we heard you there rather concerned about the impact that it could have on households. On reflection... has it had an impact? Was it a good idea?
I'm not sure we can really see the true impact thus far, because we were only talking 4 or 5 months ago. So it's more of a slower burn on that, because, you know, how people's Christmases might go have gone, you know, how much they've had to save up for gifts and all that sort of thing, puts another strain on finances. We've seen that having a knock-on effect to retail, I believe. I think that, you know, people are kind of cutting back a little bit. And, you know, we've had years of wages not exactly growing particularly fast. We might see another interest rate rise this year. Who knows? We'll see how it plays out with Brexit, which is the big thing to happen first. We have seen, though, one of the consequences of the interest rate rise, savings rates have started to nudge up a little bit higher. I can safely say that 2018 was a slightly brighter one for savers, which is a very rare line for me to say on this podcast, Georgie, because we always talk about how low savings rates are and how things have been stuck in the doldrums. But we've had our savings rate predictions for 2019 come in. A couple of the experts believe we might be looking at some savings rates touching 3% this year, which would be the first time for a very long time. So savers might start seeing that little chink of light. The real worry is for people that have debts or have mortgage payments that are linked to interest rate rises. So, you know, that adds a little bit more strain onto your monthly bill. But best advice, as always at this time of year, is to take a real stock of your finances, have a look at your ins and outs, see if you can remortgage, see if you can cut on your energy bills, see where it is you can cut back, and see where it is where you can start squirreling away a little bit of money, maybe into one of these new savings accounts that are offering a little bit more interest. And hopefully by the end of the year, you'll be in a bit of better financial health, even if there is another interest rate rise.
Indeed. Widening it out a bit, Simon, what were your thoughts on reflection? Good idea?
I thought it was a good idea. I think we need to get interest rates up so that we have the firepower.
As much as the
that
Fed?
We need. Well, the Fed's going great guns with its rate rises. And that's starting to get people a little bit nervous. I mean, we're only talking about a year ago when people were nervous for the Fed not to raise rates because it wouldn't be seen as a vote of confidence in the US economy. I think they're doing the right thing. Record low interest rates were meant to be an emergency measure. We need to get them off the floor. I'm not advocating we suddenly whack them up to 5% in one fell swoop, but we do need to start trying to get at least in the direction of normal, because when we get a recession, we're going to have to cut them again. Something very interesting has happened, though, since the rate rise, and that is that mortgage rates have barely budged. Mortgage rates are still pretty much as cheap as they have ever been. And what's going on there is that the banks, which are reasonably healthy and would quite like to lend out money to people, are struggling to find people to lend it to. There's not as many homeowners wanting to take out mortgages as was expected, so there's been a bit of a price war going on. Be interesting to see how long that one is maintained for.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
So back in September, we addressed what at first glance looked a rather champagne problem, should we put it that way, for one of our readers. What do you do about the threat of inheritance tax and losing the home that you currently share with your elderly parents? A home, in this case, worth nearly £10 million. OK, so you may not live somewhere costing quite that much, but inheritance tax is affecting more and more people. So this is an issue that got many of you interested. How do you make sure you aren't turfed out of your home? You have a reader, Simon, living with and raising his son in his childhood home, which I imagine there's quite a few people doing that. Now, his parents, in their 70s, also live there as well. But the issue here is that the property was bought in a very central part of London back in the 70s. and would now be worth many millions of pounds. So how can they make sure that they aren't turfed out due to inheritance tax? I think is essentially the nub of the issue rather than the fact they're now in a multi-million pound property, which I imagine most people won't find themselves in that particular situation, but may find themselves in a situation of being turfed out of their home.
Yes, this is not a problem that many people will share. However, it won't be unique in London and the South East. We are talking about a scenario where there is a generation of homeowners in their 60s, their 70s, who could have bought houses as relatively ordinary individuals. They would have been comfortable in life in order to buy those properties, but they wouldn't have been considered particularly rich if they'd bought them in the 70s and the early 80s. And then what has happened is a combination of astronomic house price inflation, gentrification of certain areas, the limited availability of properties to purchase has seen house prices in some of those areas go absolutely stratospheric. I mean, for example, to take a place up the road from where we work in High Street, Kensington, if you go up to Notting Hill, you could have bought one of those big 3-4 story townhouses for maybe £500,000-£600,000 at some point in the 1990s. You would now own a house that is probably worth £7 million. So it's
it, do we know how much this particular house?
We don't know how much this particular house is worth, but the reader who wrote in said high single digit millions. So we are talking nearly £10 million. Now, in theory, if your family owns such a property, a £10 million property, or even if you go outside of London to the commuter belt, perhaps to places like St Albans, Radlett, Harpenden, Weybridge, it might be a £2 million property. But whilst in theory you benefit from this, other than having a nice feeling that your house is worth lots of money, and there's a certain amount of comfort that comes from the fact that your mortgage is either minuscule compared to the outsized value of your house, or actually you paid off your mortgage long ago and you've got an asset worth a couple of million pounds, there is no real benefit from that property unless you basically either do two things. Move out, which lots of these people don't want to do because it's their family home and they want to live in that area. They like their community, they like their family home. Or you load up on debt, take out a big mortgage against it, and then start spending the money. So really the benefit comes from those properties for these families in terms of inheritance. But if it's your home and you want to stay living there, or it's your family home and you think, well, you know what I'd really like to do is I don't want to sell that house. I don't want the millions of pounds. I'd like to move into it. I want it to continue to be our family home, to continue living in this community. Ultimately, you could lose it due to inheritance tax, because inheritance tax is 40%. Everybody has an allowance of £325,000. A married couple can double that up to £650,000. There is a new main residence allowance that is being filtered in, which will cover people who have a family home that is passed to a direct descendant, up, meaning they can pass on £1 million tax-free. But once your estate goes above £2 million, you start having that taken off you. So once you get to £2.7 million, you've lost it completely and you're back down to £650,000. Now, if you're in the position of having a house that's worth high single-digit millions, you're going to have £650,000 of it that is inheritance tax-free, and the rest of it is going to have a tax charge on it. So you could be looking at a tax charge of £3-3.5 million. Now, the only way you're going to be able to pay that tax charge is by selling the house, because unless you've got £3.5 million in your back pocket, or you can't even mortgage the house for £3.5 million to pay it because you can't afford the repayments on the mortgage. Yeah. Anyway,
what's the advice?
The good news is that there is a way of dealing with this.
Okay.
So the advice that we've got here is from Stuart Thorne, a trust and estates practitioner who specialises in lifetime tax planning and succession issues of Clark Wilmot LLP. So that's his credentials. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he said, let's assume for the sake of calculation, the house is mortgage-free and worth, say, £8.65 million. Okay, so high single digits. If your parents do nothing, they have nil rate bands totalling £650,000, as we discussed before, but they don't have any main residence nil rate band because they're worth more than £2.7 million. As we discussed, that gets taken off you. Inheritance tax from the estate would therefore currently be £3.2 million. £3.2 million! Yeah. Now, he said some financial advisors might suggest things like leaving things alone, taking out equity release, taking out some kind of expensive whole-of-life insurance policy, which would be very expensive for that kind of money. But he said the simple answer is for your parents to make a gift, a substantial share to you and or your son as soon as possible. Then, provided they survive the gift by 7 years and they don't fall foul of some special rules called reservation of benefit, that I'll explain in a minute, the value gifted would fall outside of the taxable estate. So he said if four of you are living there, it would be reasonable to give a 50% share. Or he said if you've got a partner there too, 60%. Giving away a share of the house then devalues the retained share. So if you give away half of your house and you no longer own half of it, your half of it becomes worth less because it's harder to sell. So he said probably by about 12%, but he said HMRC will easily accept 10%. So you could, that would take it down 10%. If you gift 50%, live 7 years, the retained element would be worth 3.8 million if prices don't go up in the meantime. Inheritance tax bill would fall from 3.2 million to 1.26 million. Starts becoming more achievable, but then I think about how many people have got 1.26 million in readies? Not that many. But he said you could minimise the tax bill still more efficiently. He said HMRC wouldn't be impressed if you tried to gift 99% of the property, but provided occupation remains genuinely shared, i.e. the parents still live there, you live there, the son lives there, and the donees don't end up paying more than their proportionate share of household outgoings, so they're not picking up all the bills. So it doesn't look like they're deliberately giving away a big chunk of the house and then still living there and still benefiting from it, then a gift of 75% would probably be accepted, and there'd be no need for a rental payment to avoid reservation of benefit. So to explain this reservation of benefit thing, the reason why you can't just give away your house to your kids early and then hope that you survive 7 years, or if you don't survive 7 years, it tapers down so you don't get hit by the full 40%, is because you can't still continue to live there. If you do continue to live there, you have to be seen not to be benefiting, deriving a benefit from it. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you have to pay market rent. So you're going to have to pay market rent to your kids, which for some people is possible, but for most people is impossible. And you also have to pay your bills. Now, if you're sharing the house and you're living there with someone and then you give them the half, you've got another slight problem, which is if it looks like you're still living there and paying all the bills, but you've just given them half of the house, that still looks like it's your house. So you have to be very careful that this looks exactly right to the tax man. Anyway, he said, if you give away the 75%, the retained share with the discount would be worth around 1.9 million. That then pushes it back below that 2 million barrier. You benefit from the main residence nil rate band. The final inheritance tax bill then, if house prices don't rise in the meantime, would be down to a much more palatable £220,000. So that's a saving of almost 3 million. So he said, assuming your parents have a good medical report, it'd be well worth investigating the cost of suitable structured 7-year term life insurance to cover potential inheritance tax. So you take out life insurance that just covers those 7 years, and you know after those 7 years there won't be any to pay. That might be surprisingly affordable. There's some other advantages, but he said final advice, get on with it and start the 7-year clock ticking. Now, there is one colossal caveat that I would add to this, and his name is Jeremy Corbyn. Now, there is a very strong chance that if we get a Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell government, the inheritance tax rules will change. They've already said that they would remove that main residence nil rate band. Who knows whether they might do something to that 7-year rule? There's even the government at the moment are looking at inheritance tax. Now, the thing is, tax changes are not meant to be backward looking, they're only meant to be forward looking. So if anybody has given away money already, they should still benefit from that 7-year rule. But who knows? We've seen lots of things happen in recent years where they haven't respected the previous tax code and done these things. So it might be that this doesn't work, but at least you'd be trying to do something.
And finally, there have been many campaigns launched by This Is Money over 2018 and before that, of course. But one that got a lot of attention was parking sharks. In October, after having a bad experience himself, our Lee took up the cause. as many as 8 million parking tickets are issued each year in the UK, but only a fraction are contested. That's despite strong evidence that you could actually beat your fine. Now, as many as 65% of appeals for penalty charge notices, to give them their proper term, are upheld and the fines are then withdrawn. Many appeals aren't even contested by local councils. Now, what's worse, as This Is Money have revealed in the past, is that your details are routinely sold by the DVLA to the private companies for as little as £2.50 a vehicle. And that generates around £1.5 million in revenue per month for the DVLA. So enough is enough, said This Is Money, and a new campaign is launched. Lee, I'm going to come to you because it wasn't too long ago a podcast passed that you got a wee bee in your bonnet after you were given a parking fine and you fought it and you won, Lee.
Yes, that's right, Georgie. So a couple of months ago, out of the blue, received a penalty charge from a private firm for parking in a BP garage, stopping us on double yellow lines there onto private land for a few minutes. Got caught on a camera and got told a £70 fine. Go up to £100 after 14 days if you don't pay it. You can appeal it through this independent body, but if you foul, you'll have to pay the £100 because it will be after the 14-day period. So people will get charges issued to them, which are probably unjustified. So we're talking about private parking firms here. We're not talking about the council. Yep. We're talking sheerly about private firms that will go and approach companies such as BP and other supermarkets and shops, retailers, and even car park operators and that sort of thing, and just start dishing out fines kind of willy-nilly on private land. Then probably no breach of the highway code. A lot of people are scared to appeal the fine. You don't want £70 to turn into £100.
Of course you don't.
So
yeah,
you go, I don't want this to go. Or even the threat of court action, I don't want this to go any further. So, do you know what? I'll just pay it, put it to bed, and I've learned from my mistake. But I think it's simply not on, Georgie. And the reason the fight back begins now is that we have been inundated from listeners, from readers of This Is Money, getting in touch with all sorts of ludicrous cases in which complete common sense would say that that shouldn't be a penalty charge. And I just think it's completely unfair. So we are launching this campaign to get three changes. But the first one of those is to give drivers the option to stop the DVLA, allowing private firms to buy their details for £2.50 a pop. So we're in a world now of GDPR.
Data protection.
We should have more protection over our own personal information and our own personal details. So why is it that we can't opt out from the DVLA, sending on our details onto private firms?
Why can't we? Why is that allowed?
Well, there's a whole load of legalese that the DVLA, which the DVLA have come back with, and I have spoken to some experts in the field as well. It's just the way that it's worded. They can basically get away with it. And we're just saying that there should be an option for us to not have those private details sold on. That's all we're asking for. So you should be able to phone up the DVLA and go, we're not talking about councils. We're not talking about authorities such as the police and other sort of bodies like that. We're talking about private firms that are dishing out these fines willy-nilly. We worked out that basically they only have to be successful in about one in every 24 fines that they send out to break even. So you can imagine what some of the profit margins can be at some of these firms. The second thing that we're asking for is for the independent appeal process to be made fairer. So if you get one of these, and let's say the fine's for £70, and you wish to, you appeal to the company first off, the likelihood is they'll say no, right? Mm-hmm. They'll just say no off the bat. You should then be able to go and appeal it through this independent body, which is called Poplar, and it's not funded by these companies. They actually bill the private firms per case that they look at. But that fine should be frozen while it's being looked into. Because at the moment, you're getting a 30, 40 quid penalty, extra penalty. If that goes to an independent body and it's turned down, there's that fear, there's that dread that it's going to get turned down. And for, a lot of people, 30, 40 quid is a lot of money.
Yeah.
So that's the other change we're asking for. And the last thing we're saying that when these private firms approach the DVLA to buy your details, if we can't get that first point to be changed, they should be including the location of the offence, the exact location of where that's happening. So if there's a flood of fines coming in every day from that BP garage in Stansted where I was caught, the DVLA should be investigating, saying, hold on a minute, how is it that all of these drivers are falling victim? Is the signage clear enough? Is this justified?
Lee, you were clearly irked by your own parking experience there. You launched the campaign. Have we seen any changes since?
We have seen some changes, actually, Georgie. So to go back to this campaign that we started, we launched it sort of in the summer, and we just want more common sense. There's far too many private firms that have popped up. They're charging people for all sorts of tiny little errors or mistakes, or in some circumstances that we've had from reading. We've had hundreds of people get in touch about this, and the stories are incredible. People slipping a digit wrong on a machine to put their registration plate in. I mean, not that long ago, you never needed to put your registration in for a parking spot, so you can't hand over your ticket to other drivers. And it's, for me, it's been another nail in the coffin for the high street as well. I think people are just so put off and so fed up with some of these car parks that they just simply go, do you know what, it's just not worth my while going to find somewhere and panicking to park. Now, what we did see at the end of November was a tiny little victory for motorists. It was already in the pipeline anyway, so this was nothing to do with us, but it was a new parking code of practice. It's a new bill which is meant to be cracking down a little bit on these private parking firms. There's going to be a 10-minute grace period for drivers. There's restrictions to a £100 fine limit, and it's meant to be more of a sort of one-stop shop to make complaints. But I still don't know if it goes far enough, and I still think that one of the issues that we are still looking at and still take issue with is the fact that the DVLA can sell on your details to these private parking companies for £2.50 a pop in a world in which GDPR rules. I still think there's something not quite right about it, and I would like to see in the new year more of these problem car parks being investigated. And I'm talking about areas in which lots of fines are getting dished out, lots of charges are getting dished out in one concentrated area. There's a car park that we've written about this year, which was in Basildon. They've been dishing out 2,000 fines a month. I'd say what's happened with that story since, a little update, is that the company involved in that didn't have planning permission for the cameras, the ANPR cameras that it installed in the car park. And the local MP has written to the firm, and it's currently going in the process of all drivers that have paid charges there getting their charges rescinded because they broke the law by putting those cameras up without having the proper planning permission. And this sort of thing, I think, is happening up and down the country. And 2019, Georgie, we will continue to fight the good fight.
Sure you will.
We will continue to investigate drivers' problems with these parking charges. We're not saying that drivers should be able to park anywhere and cause havoc, but there should be way more common sense. And 2019 is the year drivers fight back and we put an end to this nonsense.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, lads. Happy New Year. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. We'll be back next week with a more detailed look of what 2019 has in store. But in the meantime, if you have any questions for the team or anything you'd like us to cover, Simon?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, come to thisismoney, go to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the articles where you can join in the debate in reader comments and call us fools.
That was not what I was expecting.
It's a great silence.
Call us what you like, and why not? But maybe make it nice because it is a new year and all that. But if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little, give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.